Well, let me begin by thanking the Colloquium Committee and the Department for this opportunity. One of the most striking aspects of the subject that I'll be telling you about is that it deals with something that we're all familiar with, namely light, and that it can do very unusual things under fairly normal conditions, such as the ones that we experience in the room right now. There is one catch, however, in order to achieve these fundamental effects, that one has to engineer very specific type of material, and those are called photonic bandgap materials. These are periodic dielectric microstructures that scatter light in a way that is analogous to how electrons are scattered in semiconductors. And one of the perhaps the most fundamental effect that underlies all the other things that happen in these materials is that they can trap or localize light, that there are localized mode solutions of Maxwell's equations in these materials. So let me begin by way of introduction to give you some background on the subject of localization. I first got interested in this subject as a beginning graduate student, inspired partly by work that was done in the 1950s by Philip Anderson and others, who studied the question of electronic propagation in solids. And as you know, if you have a crystalline solid, you get bands. And what Anderson studied was what happens if you try to disorder that solid. If you do that, you start to have some states of that band which are localized. They no longer can conduct electricity, whereas others are extended and are propagating. And eventually, if you add enough disorder into the system, the entire band can consist of localized states, and this leads to a metal insulator transition referred to as the Anderson transition, something for which he received the Nobel Prize in 1977. So as a graduate student, I was interested in whether these same effects could appear for other types of classical waves, in particular vibrational modes in a solid, elastic waves. And so in studying that problem, I was able to show that if you introduce disorder into a solid, one could create some localized vibrational modes near the upper frequency cutoff of the vibrational band or the Debye cutoff. But no matter how much disorder you introduce into the system, that the states at low frequencies or long wavelengths would always be propagating or extended due to a phenomenon called Rayleigh scattering. Having done that, I wanted to ask whether the same effect could occur for electromagnetic waves. Here, again, you have the phenomenon of what's called Rayleigh scattering at long wavelengths, but at the same time, there's no natural upper frequency cutoff for electromagnetic waves. And I suggested in 1984, as part of my PhD thesis, that under suitable conditions, you might be able to have at least some states localized, whereas in electronics you could have all the states localized, and this requires very careful conditions. And as you may notice, Anderson himself wrote a paper on the same subject of light localization about a year afterwards, referring to some of what I did and saying that he agreed with almost all of it except for one point which he disagreed with. And actually he invited me to Princeton to discuss that one point where we disagreed, and of course being just a graduate student, I thought I was in big trouble at that point. And I went to his office, and he asked me to explain it, and I derived everything on the board. And I was then very surprised at his response at that point, which was to ask me whether I would repeat that explanation. So I was getting even more nervous now. I did it once more, and after that was done, I was just bracing myself for what he would say, but I was even more surprised. He actually asked me, well, would you consider a teaching position at Princeton? So some of you who are looking for positions might use that tip, if that helps. Anyway, I must say that localization of light is something that's rather unusual, especially if you know a little bit of quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, you know that you have propagating or scattering states at positive energies, and bound states of negative energies. So if we try to construct an analogy between the electromagnetic wave equation and Schrodinger's equation, you get a picture that looks something like this, that you could have a spatially varying dielectric constant which fluctuates about some average value, epsilon zero, and Unlike electronics, where you could have bound states at negative energy, say, caught in a potential well like this, the constraint here is that if epsilon zero is always greater than minus epsilon fluctuation, meaning that the dielectric constant is everywhere positive, corresponding to non-dissipative materials, this would mean that what one is looking for are bound states at energies higher than the highest potential barrier. So in quantum mechanics, you might wonder, how can that be? How can you have bound states within the positive energy spectrum? And as it turns out, photonic bandgap materials are periodic structures that allow you to realize this. And what you're seeing here is actually a finite difference time domain simulation of light within a periodic dielectric structure, where I have removed material above and below to just show you a planar cut. This is a material that has a photonic bandgap. And in the middle, I've removed one of these dielectric rods. And you see this trapped state of light inside, where the green and the red arrows correspond to the magnetic and electric fields, respectively. Magenta corresponds to where the energy density is residing. This has some rather unusual features. Of course, everyone knows that in microcavity resonators, you can trap light for some period of time. Here, you could literally trap it indefinitely if the size of your system is large enough. But perhaps an even more striking feature of this is that here you can have the light intensity concentrated in air, or the low index component of this material. That's where a rod was removed. That's very different than microcavity resonators, where you might trap light for some short time by the mechanism of total internal reflection, meaning that light intensity has to be in the high refractive index component. And so this by itself, the fact that you can trap light with a very small mode volume on the order of the wavelength of light itself in air, has a number of practical applications. One of which is already almost at a commercial level. It's shown here. Here you see standard optical fiber, which guides light through the telecommunications network. This is guided by this mechanism of total internal reflection, where you have a core which has a higher index than the background. In what are called photonic crystal or photonic bandgap fibers, one can actually guide light within a air core by creating this two-dimensional array of holes that goes throughout the entire length of the fiber. And this defect in this otherwise periodic background, which again can trap a localized state of light as far as escape into these transverse directions is concerned, and then guide it along the axis of the fiber. What this means in communications is that one might achieve lower losses, one might have different or larger bandwidths in which one can conduct light, and one may also control the dispersion of light over long distances in this manner. Another application is in the area of biosensing. If you were to use this as some sort of a sensor to, measure some property of some liquid around it for a standard fiber, you would only be able to couple to what you want to sense through the evanescent field that comes out of the fiber. Here, you could have what you want to sense right inside the fiber, so greater intensity reaches the point that you want to sense. And finally, one of the other applications which I foresee in the future is using these types of fibers for coupling light in and out of photonic bandgap microchips, which I'll come to later. Another application which has to deal, here you just see what happens if you don't do it correctly, that if you couple light from the fiber to the photonic bandgap, a lot of it scatters out. Another application related to biology comes from the area of clinical medicine, and this was a story that was reported at the end of 2004, where these types of photonic bandgap fibers were actually used to deliver a high-intensity laser pulse for the purpose of doing surgery, that is, removing a tumor. If you tried to do that with a standard optical fiber with a solid core, the very high intensity of light would actually damage the solid core of the fiber, and it wouldn't be entirely predictable what would happen then. However, there was a case where a patient actually, about a year ago, had a condition called this recurrent respiratory papilloma or tumor. Here you see the trachea of a normal healthy patient, and here you see some pictures in which this tumor appears inside the trachea. And this condition is a recurrent condition. Even if you treat it, remove it by surgery, it keeps coming back. And so this patient had reached the point where she had undergone so many surgeries that it just became impractical to put her through the trauma of additional incision and surgery, that literally the only choice was to use some sort of fiber-guided mechanism. And so the Food and Drug Administration actually approved the use of this photonic bandgap fiber, which could be sent through a standard endoscope, guiding a sufficiently strong laser field to the tumor, and was able to be managed that way. And so this is a first example of a person whose life was saved, actually, by the use of these fibers. And I think there are a number of major institutions in the U.S., at least, who have bought systems like this, at least for the purpose of evaluation. And I think there's a very interesting future for these types of medical applications. Okay, let me move then to three-dimensional photonic bandgap materials, which is the main topic of my colloquium today. Here is where the University of Toronto group got into the microfabrication of photonic bandgap materials. This is a structure that was made next door in Jeff Ozen's lab in chemistry. It's something called a silicon inverse opal. So it consists of spherical shells of silicon, which have been deposited by a particular method, which I won't go into details of right now, formed into a face-centered cubic lattice. Each of these spheres has a diameter of 870 nanometers. And as a result of this careful preparation of polycrystalline silicon into this structure, this material has this property, which I call the photonic bandgap, at a wavelength which is the wavelength of choice for telecommunications, namely 1.5 micron wavelength. And so this was a very nice collaboration between physicists and chemists to realize the structure. Now, I should tell you that not every periodic structure like this has a photonic bandgap. One has to achieve very careful and delicate conditions, and that is illustrated in the next slide, where you see a structure, first of all, which has the wrong type of amount of silicon in it, just 20% by volume fraction. Here is what's called the Brillouin zone of this FCC lattice. It's basically a region in the momentum space of photons. And what I'll do is to look at various directions of propagation of light through this crystal labeled by these points K, X, W, and so on, and ask what is the electromagnetic dispersion relation along those directions. So here what I'll do is that as this arrow sweeps from the K equals zero point out to the surface of this Brillouin zone, I'll plot in these blue lines the electromagnetic dispersion. There are some red regions which correspond to gaps where in that particular direction there are no electromagnetic modes, and the red regions will keep track of the intersection of those gaps as I sweep along different directions here. So as I vary the direction of propagation, the stop gaps actually disappear. So in this particular example, there is no overall photonic band gap. The dispersion relation shows a structure that's sort of a spaghetti-like diagram. Lots of bands, but no complete gap appearing. So now let's go back to a more carefully microfabricated structure in which the volume fraction of silicon is 25%, and repeat that exercise of looking at the dispersion relations along various directions. Here you see that as I sweep and look at the intersections of the gaps, this red region continues to persist. And this corresponds to the existence of a complete photonic band gap, absence of any electromagnetic modes over that spectral range. Another way of visualizing that same effect is shown in what I call a phase space picture. So imagine now that these are the three directions of K space or momentum space, directions in which light can propagate. And let's consider what are the modes that are available to light at a particular frequency. So what I'm showing here is what's called an isofrequency surface, meaning that every point on this surface at this frequency corresponds to a different direction that light can propagate. Right now, I'm looking at a frequency which is very low, and the wavelength is very long compared to the scale of the microstructure. So you get a spherical surface, much like you would have in ordinary vacuum, that light can propagate equally well in all directions. As I raise the frequency and make the wavelength comparable to the scattering microstructures themselves, you see that this surface deforms, and eventually some holes start appearing in the band structure, meaning that along these particular directions, there are no possible modes available for propagation. And I'll go through various bands of the structure corresponding to different colors in this picture. So you're going through a series of bands here described by different colors. Eventually, you reach a frequency range here where the entire phase space disappears. That means that there are no modes available over that interval of frequencies, which I showed. So you could think of that region as being one which you could say is almost emptier than the vacuum itself. Even the zero-point fluctuations of the electromagnetic vacuum have been eliminated over that range of frequencies. And this illustrates how the localization mechanism works, that by reducing the number of pathways for light to propagate within a certain frequency interval, if one introduces some scattering center on top of the otherwise periodic microstructure, it is very easy to trap or localize light by destructive interference of any of its escape channels. This type of surface is something analogous to a Fermi surface in solid-state physics, but it has a different type of physical significance in the case of optics. In fact, it has a lot to do with how light refracts from, say, air into a different medium. There's been a lot of interest lately in effects such as negative refraction, and photonic crystals also allow unusual effects in how light coming in from the outside would refract into the medium. Here you see the plane of incidence just rotating and the refracted beam as it enters, described by some sort of a Snell's law. And one can look at this in two different pictures, either the real space or coordinate space picture here, or in the momentum space picture on the left-hand side. So let's imagine that one has a medium whose refractive index is 2, and we're coming in with light from air with an index of 1. Let me draw the isofrequency surfaces for both of these situations. Inside the medium with refractive index 2, the radius of that isofrequency surface is double that which it would be in air. And the properties of refraction can basically be regarded as expressing the conservation of energy and momentum of the photons as they enter the medium. So let's begin with a photon which has a particular wave vector in air, say the incident wave vector shown here, and we'd like to make sure that the component of momentum parallel to this interface is conserved as it enters the medium. So I'll draw a parallel wave vector here, and below that you see the refracted beam. Now, the refracted beam will also, the energy of that will move in the direction of the group velocity, which corresponds to the tangential surface to this outer isofrequency surface. So what I'm trying to get at is that if one can engineer the shape of these isofrequency surfaces, as I showed in the previous slide, one can achieve almost any type of refractive effect that you want, whether it be negative refraction, even refraction that occurs out of the plane of incidence. Very, very, very unusual effects. Okay, so that's some of the opportunity, but again, let me come back to the point that I made at the beginning, that to realize any of these effects, one has to manufacture photonic bandgap materials in a very precise and accurate way. And here I just review some of the requirements. One needs a material with a high refractive index, such as silicon, which has an index at 1.5 microns, which is close to 3.5. It should be of high purity and non-absorbing, and one requires a very precise architecture that would lead to this large and robust photonic band gap. And finally, if you're interested in applications, you have to be able to produce it to perfection on a very large scale with practically no cost, almost impossible requirements, it might seem. This type of challenge has occurred throughout the history of technology, not only in the development of semiconductor physics itself, but even the technology that preceded semiconductors, namely vacuum tubes. In fact, when the first light bulb was made, many people believed that this would simply provide a niche market for very rich people. And this actually led to the very famous quotation by Thomas Edison that I will make the light bulb so cheap that only the rich can afford to burn candles. And so in a sense, that is our task today, to make photonic band gaps so cheap that only the rich can afford to use anything else. And I'll suggest some steps towards a possible solution to this problem based on some lithography techniques, which we've been developing here in collaboration with experimental groups. And not only to make photonic bandgap materials, but to have functional architectures in which one can do things like guide light, perform operations through an integrated optical circuit, also engineer the atom radiation interaction to observe interesting effects, and perhaps have applications to things like switching. So here's one of the ways in which we've started to address this issue. This is a technique called direct laser writing of photonic crystals. Here, what you do is start with what is called a polymer-based photoresist, and you can focus a laser beam, say, close to 800 nanometer wavelength into a small region called a voxel. The intensity is sufficiently strong there that it causes two photon absorption from that laser beam into the photoresist. And when that absorption takes place, a reaction occurs in which this polymer undergoes some sort of cross-linking. And then one can move the laser pen throughout this photoresist to create whatever structure that you want. Under development of the photoresist, one can dissolve or wash away the uncross-linked regions where the laser pen did not expose, leaving behind only the places that one has written on. So here you see a particular architecture, which is called an SP2 or slanted pore structure. It consists of two columns of rods per unit cell forming a periodic structure. Now, this has the right architecture, but unfortunately the photoresist only has a refractive index of about 1.6, and so you can't get any photonic bandgap with a structure like this. And so to address this problem, in collaboration again with Jeff Ozen's group in chemistry and a group in Karlsruhe, Germany, we've developed a method for taking that polymer photoresist and replicating it with silicon. So here you start with the photoresist, which is called SU8, direct laser write it and develop it. That shows it in step two. And then as a precursor to trying to put silicon in, which would destroy the structure if you tried to put it into a silicon CVD chamber, what you do is a technique developed, a very clever method by Jeff and his group, to fill this at room temperature with silicon dioxide and then remove the excess SiO2 so that you can expose the photoresist again and then burn off the photoresist, leaving behind a silica or glass inverse replica of the original polymer photoresist. And once you have it made into glass, that can now withstand the heat required for silicon chemical vapor deposition. And that is then done here. Then the silica can be removed by a wet etching, passing hydrofluoric acid through the structure, which eats away the silica and leaves the silicon behind. And what you see at the bottom are some electron micrographs of actually a wood pile-like structure, which consists now of pure polycrystalline silicon, which is an exact replica of the laser-written structure on photoresist. And so what this demonstrates is that we can take any architecture which one can write by this laser process and then replicate it with a high-index semiconductor, in this case, silicon. So that provides enormous flexibility in what you can do. Here's a second example of direct laser writing into another type of structure. These are chalcogenide glasses, or 2-6 semiconductors, as they're called. These have slightly higher refractive indices, and so one can actually achieve a photonic band gap, perhaps in the visible spectrum, directly in these structures. Again, direct laser writing leads to two-photon absorption into these chalcogenide glasses. What happens is that when you thermally evaporate AS2S3, it forms these cage-like molecules, and when you expose it to light and it undergoes two-photon absorption, these rings open and the material locally polymerizes again, and under development you can dissolve away these cage-like molecules to leave behind only the polymerized structure. So here you see direct laser writing of a woodpile-like structure into AS2S3, and in fact the Karlsruhe group was able to measure a small photonic band gap here over some spectral range. Now, direct laser writing is very powerful, but it's not very practical if you want to make very large wafer-scale structures on the size of centimeters. And so it's useful to consider some more parallel process for doing that. And for that purpose, many people have considered another technique called multi-beam interference lithography or holographic lithography. Here, you have the same sort of photoresist, but you send four laser beams into the structure. They form an interference pattern, which is expressed by taking the square of the electric field amplitude here. And this interference pattern has peaks and valleys. When the intensity exceeds a certain threshold, again, photopolymerization occurs, and one can replicate the optical intensity pattern by this process using the steps that I showed before. And it turns out that for suitable choices of beam polarizations, amplitudes, phases, and beam directions, one can actually achieve the right sort of architecture for a photonic band gap. The question that we've been asking is that can something like this be simplified to yield a very large photonic band gap, but with a much simpler experimental setup? One of the issues here is that if you're coming in with laser beams from all different directions, it's a little bit hard to place the photoresist onto a substrate and do this. So can one come up with some different arrangement of beams, or can one come up with a completely different approach entirely? And that's what I'll come to, based on just using a single laser beam rather than multi-beam interference. Let me first show you that multi-beam interference can, in fact, create a photonic band gap material. Here, if you want to create a face-centered cubic lattice, you have to create an intensity interference pattern, which is basically a sum of these four cosines. And if you want to get a photonic band gap, the coefficients multiplying these cosines should be either plus or minus one, and that's obtained by choosing the polarizations and beam amplitudes, et cetera, correctly. It turns out that if you choose all the coefficients to be unity, you get something that looks like this, which is basically a face-centered cubic lattice of spherical iso-intensity surfaces, or something like an opal structure that doesn't have a photonic band gap. But if you phase shift this last cosine to end up having a minus sign here, in fact, you get something that looks very much like this diamond network structure that you saw momentarily there. I'll try to freeze it again. There, that's a diamond network structure, and that actually does have a large three-dimensional photonic band gap. Again, this requires multi-beam interference. It's not a particularly simple thing to implement. What we were able to show recently, and this is part of the PhD thesis of a student, Timothy Chan, that one can actually reproduce a lot of what is done by multi-beam interference by designing a suitable optical phase mask, which basically is a diffraction grating, which you see depicted here. It consists of grooves going along one direction and then orthogonally to that in the other direction, separated by a solid plate. And the idea here is that if you shine a single laser beam through this structure, then you get a set of diffracted beams that comes out on the other side, which can expose a photoresist according to some intensity pattern, such as what I've shown here. By choosing the parameters of this phase mask appropriately, one can cause all but the lowest order diffracted beams, which are shown here, just five of them, all but those five to be evanescent. So in the end, you only get five, the central beam and the first order diffracted beams coming through. And using that, one can actually produce interference diffraction pattern, which again reproduces something very close to this diamond lattice structure. So we believe that this is actually represents a new paradigm for photonic bandgap microfabrication, in which the entire architecture of the photonic bandgap is literally encoded on this simple holographic phase plate, and then by sending in a single laser beam with a polarization which is 45 degrees with respect to these gratings, one can create iso-intensity patterns, as are shown here. These are different iso-intensity values that you're seeing here in different colors here. The brown region is approximately the ideal iso-intensity pattern for creating this photonic bandgap structure. And the phase plate not only provides the correct directions to the beams, it also chooses the relative phases between these diffracted beams, again simplifying the whole process of this type of optical lithography. So if you look here, this is the optimized iso-intensity surface. You see that the peak intensities basically follow a structure which just looks exactly like where the atoms would sit in a diamond lattice. So one can recreate a very interesting structure like that by choosing the phase plate parameters appropriately. And here's the result, the final structure, which would look like this in the polymer photoresist. If that is then replicated with silicon using the techniques that I showed before, it would lead to a band structure diagram that looks like this, in which one has a huge three-dimensional photonic band gap spanning about 24% of the center frequency here, which at a wavelength, if this was 1.5 microns, this would be a bandwidth of about 380 nanometers. And this just shows you the size of the photonic bandgap reaching close to 25% as a function of the volume fraction of the silicon that would make up this structure. If you deviate from the ideal volume fraction, then the size of the gap disappears. So this is a way in which one might be able to come close to this Edisonian dream of making photonic crystals very easy to and very readily available. Not only does one want to make photonic bandgaps, one wants to have some sort of functionality to them. For example, to be able to guide light along waveguides, to create microchips for processing light. And so for that, one needs to create some sort of a defect in the otherwise periodic three-dimensional structure. And this is an architecture that we suggested a few years ago for doing that. It's called a 2D, 3D heterostructure, in which we embed a two-dimensional periodic photonic crystal in between two sandwiching regions of three-dimensional photonic bandgap. This leads to some structure inside the otherwise empty photonic bandgap. By creating this planar defect, one creates some guided modes shown by dark lines in which light can propagate in this two-dimensional plane, or this microchip, as I refer to it. But still, if you choose the parameters correctly, one can leave behind this hatched region, which continues to be a three-dimensional photonic bandgap. One can then leave out rows of rods here to act as waveguide channels within this on-chip photonic bandgap, and then presumably be able to manipulate it on a sub-wavelength scale. And so here you see some of the first examples of microfabricated heterostructures, again done with collaboration with our friends in Karlsruhe, Germany. This was done by direct laser writing. So here you see a wood pile structure above and below, a three-dimensional periodic structure sandwiched by this two-dimensional periodic array of rods. And then you see a line of rods that has been removed, which could then act as an air waveguide channel, which guides light by this localization mechanism. And we're now in the process of trying to replicate this architecture with silicon using this double inversion technique. And so this opens up the possibility of developing new types of microchips, analogous, if you like, to electronic microchips, but which guide light through waveguide channels. In electronics, you have largely two-dimensional microchips. There may be layers of interconnections that go into the third dimension, but it's largely two-dimensional. And there's great interest in increasing the speed of your computer chips by making things smaller and smaller. But as you make silicon microchips smaller and smaller, and the feature size becomes smaller and the density of components gets larger, there's more and more heat that's generated. And so this scaling, according to Moore's law, is not expected to continue much longer because of this heat management problem. As electrical resistance is generated over a very small volume, one has to have a very good way of managing that heat, which is now done through your chip fan. In the case of light, there is no heat dissipation. Here, light is being guided through air. Unlike electronics, which is just a single channel of information propagating through wires, here you can literally have many hundreds of different wavelength channels of different information simultaneously propagating through these waveguide networks. And here you see an actual design of a three-dimensional circuit where light can be guided from one microchip layer, guided up by a waveguide, which I didn't explain what these blue boxes are, but these are regions where the dielectric of the 3D photonic band gap is removed, which acts as an air waveguide channel, which connects light from one microchip channel to the other. So you have these two extra dimensions of integration. First, the third geometrical dimension of integration, and you have this additional dimension of frequency space, or which is conjugate to the time variable, so I call it 3+1 dimensional integrated optics. And the density of information here that can be carried can be quite competitive to even the most optimistic estimates from nanoelectronics. So here you see an actual finite difference time domain simulation and the results of propagation along this air waveguide network for a particular structure. I've removed the 3D photonic bandgap material in between these microchip layers so you can actually visualize the propagation of light. So here you see the electric field vector in red propagating down this air waveguide channel. This is light at 1.5 microns. The spacing between these rods would be 600 nanometers. So the wavelength is, the size of this waveguide channel is sub-wavelength. The green arrows represent the magnetic field, which is circulating around the electric field as it propagates along here. This is guiding by the localization mechanism because the intensity is focused in air. It's an air waveguide, and there's no possibility of diffraction into any other direction because it's surrounded by a photonic bandgap where there are simply no modes available for propagation. So here you're now traveling along with the red and green arrows. This is a bit longer than I had intended. But there's essentially a universal design for having these 3D circuit paths where these links from one microchip layer to the next can be created by this zigzag pattern of removed dielectric. The blue arrows represent the pointing vector, so this is showing how energy is flowing from one microchip layer along the vertical link to the next one. And if you do the careful study of the transmission along this as a function of wavelength, you see that over a bandwidth of anywhere between 100 and 200 nanometers, you get very good transmission around these very sharp sub-wavelength apertures. If you tried to do this in standard optics, you would get enormous diffraction if you tried to bend light over that short length scale. So this demonstrates the possibility of confining light on these microchips and guiding it in a way that was never possible before. Now, going beyond just passive guiding of light, one wants to consider other types of functionality. Another thing that photonic bandgaps do is to control spontaneous emission of light. One of the most common examples of spontaneous emission that we experience is thermal spontaneous emission, or black body radiation. And the question has arisen, can photonic bandgap materials have some influence on the nature of black body radiation? Say, for instance, if one takes a filament that is structured like a photonic crystal and then drives a current through it, heating it up to a certain temperature, effectively, can one come up with a more efficient light-emitting filament or light bulb? Recently, It was shown that in this type of tungsten-based woodpile structure created by a group at Sandia Labs, some very unusual features were actually observed in the blackbody spectrum that comes out of that structure. What they observed is shown in the experimental data down here. In a standard blackbody, you get a peak in the emission corresponding to each particular temperature, and that peak shifts according to the changes in temperature. In this particular tungsten woodpile structure, it was observed that the peak emission by heating could actually be pinned to a particular wavelength over a certain range of temperatures, and some other unusual features appeared which seemed to have something to do with the structure rather than just the thermodynamics of the system. This is the band structure diagram of the tungsten woodpile. Since it's made of metal, what you have is a plasma cutoff frequency which prevents any light propagating through the interior below this cutoff frequency, and you get a large set of bands here. And it's believed that these features are associated with some detailed aspects of the photonic band structure here. So this made us think, can one take this preliminary observation and make it into something more dramatic, that is, have a peak that is placed in the visible spectrum, which is much more robust than the pinning of the peak as you see here. That is, can one come up with an architecture such that the peak would occur in the visible? This would require a material which has a much higher plasma frequency than tungsten. It also requires a material that has a very high melting temperature, say close to 3,000 degrees. So you can't use materials like silver, which have a high plasma frequency but a low melting point. And then to place an isolated passband somewhere below the plasma cutoff frequency. And this particular architecture is one that satisfies those properties. It's called a spiral structure. It can be made by a variety of techniques, which I won't go into. But I'll show you the band structure properties if this architecture were consisting of air inside these cylinders and a particular metal, iridium, outside, which has this very high plasma frequency and a melting point of about 3,000 degrees. So here you see the band structure of that particular architecture. Here, if the lattice constant of the spiral is chosen to be 400 nanometers, one can place an isolated passband which occupies a significant fraction of the visible spectrum, which is well separated and cut off from the rest of the continuum below the plasma cutoff frequency. And this is just a simulation, again, of the electromagnetic field associated with this passband, in which light is actually propagating through the percolating network of interior air holes inside this spiral structure. And this means that if you have thermal light emitters, then light from the interior of the structure coming outwards only has this available electromagnetic density of states to work with, so it places a peak even in thermal emission which occurs within this isolated passband. In this case, that can be put at about 650 nanometers, and it has a reasonably width associated with it. And one can go into more detail and ask where these modes actually come from. It comes from a sort of a box-like structure inside this spiral arms, where you have intersections between these spiral arms and sort of a grill-like structure where electromagnetic field is concentrated inside these boxes and then propagates from one box to the next and then can pass through the entire structure. So these are sort of grill-like structures where the electromagnetic field is generated by current-driven heat generation. And so this, again, underscores another very interesting possibility of what you can do with photonic bandgap materials, engineering the electromagnetic spectrum. One can look a little bit more detail as to the nature of the change in the electromagnetic spectrum and what it could do to atoms that you might place inside of a photonic bandgap, or in particular, quantum electrodynamics of atom radiation interactions. Suppose that you do place an atom with a transition frequency omega zero, which happens to land inside this photonic band gap. Well, the light has no modes available to propagate, so it can't go anywhere. But as you know from quantum mechanics, even if there aren't any modes at that frequency, if there are modes at some neighboring frequency, it can still tunnel some distance away from the atom before having to come back. And although spontaneous emission is eliminated, one can have a state which we refer to as a photon-atom bound state, or an eigenstate of the quantum electrodynamic Hamiltonian, which is a linear superposition of the excited atomic state and a photon which occasionally orbits around it. And mathematically that appears as is shown here. If you consider quantum electrodynamics an ordinary vacuum in which the dispersion relation for light is just featureless, straight line, if you look at the eigensolutions, you get a continuum of solutions for all positive energies corresponding to the scattering states of light from the atom. You get a solution in the complex energy plane, which corresponds to the excited atom, which has a finite lifetime, corresponding to the imaginary part of that solution. If you do that in the photonic band gap, this solution actually moves to the real energy axis in between the bands above and below, and this describes this photon-atom bound state. And this has actually started a whole area in quantum optics of trying to understand what the consequences of this type of effect are. What I'd like to do is to discuss how that might be used practically for, say, applications in, say, optical switching or even optical transistor type of effects. Now, the idea of optical transistors goes back almost 30 years. One of the earliest ideas was by Hyatt Gibbs and his collaborators. They just considered a very simple but compelling architecture for creating an all-optical transistor. What they said is that let's take a pair of dielectric mirrors, place some nonlinear optical material inside, and then use this as what's called a Fabry-Perot resonator or cavity, so that when you shine light from one side, then if the light is at the right frequency, it will transmit. There's a transmission resonance. And if you now pump this medium with some other laser beam, it can nonlinearly shift the refractive index of what's in here, and that can correspondingly shift the transmission resonance out of resonance with the beam that you wanted to send through. So thereby, by using this secondary laser beam, you can switch the beam that I show in red from being transmitted to being reflected, controlling light with light. Now, one of the problems here is that this has a fundamental limitation. That is, if you want this switching to occur very easily, that is, with very low intensity pumping, you need a very narrow transmission resonance for this probe beam here, which means that the cavity here has to have a very high quality factor, so that you only have to shift it by a little bit to move it out of resonance. Unfortunately, if you have a very narrow frequency resonance, if you think about it from Fourier analysis, time is conjugate to frequency. It means something very narrow in frequency means it takes a very long time for light to get in and out of the cavity, or that the switching time becomes very long, the lower the intensity required for switching. And that can actually be illustrated very graphically in photonic crystals themselves. Here's a Fabry-Perot cavity that is embedded into a waveguide in a photonic crystal. These three rods act as mirrors surrounding this cavity. We consider a pulse that is now going through this structure. Initially, it's reflected, but as the intensity builds up in this cavity, the refractive index of the cavity can be changed. So we start with an initial cavity which has a transmission spectrum that is peaked here, and we send in a light that has its frequency spectrum centered at the green line. And we can nonlinearly shift the transmission spectrum of this, as is shown here, as light intensity builds up. But as you see here, what happens in practice is that the response of the medium, which changes the transmission spectrum, causes it to overshoot the spectrum of the light that's being sent in. And the higher the Q factor of the cavity, the more of these oscillations take place. This leads to slowing down the switching time. It also leads to a distortion of the pulse that comes out of the structure. So here in black is the initial frequency spectrum of the pulse, and what came out here is this blue line. It's being distorted. And so this may not be good if you want to be sending information through this structure and you don't want the data to be destroyed in the process. So what we've been asking is, are there other ways in which one can use the photonic band gap concept to control light with light, namely by engineering the electromagnetic density of states? And here's an architecture in which we've proposed that that might be done. This is a waveguide channel in the three-dimensional photonic bandgap microchip, which actually has two waveguide modes associated with it. And these waveguide modes have the property that one of them exhibits a very sharp cutoff inside the photonic bandgap. The other one has relatively linear dispersion. And what we want to ask is, what if we place quantum dots or other light emitters adjacent to this waveguide, which were those striped rods as it propagates along here? This is guiding by the localization mechanism because the intensity is focused in air. It's an air waveguide, and there's no possibility of diffraction into any other direction because it's surrounded by a photonic band gap where there are simply no modes available for propagation. So here you're now traveling along with the red and green arrows. This is a bit longer than I had intended. But there's essentially a universal design for having these 3D circuit paths where these links from one microchip layer to the next can be created by this zigzag pattern of removed dielectric. The blue arrows represent the pointing vector, so this is showing how energy is flowing from one microchip layer along the vertical link to the next one. And if you do the careful study of the transmission along this as a function of wavelength, you see that over a bandwidth of anywhere between 100 and 200 nanometers, you get very good transmission around these very sharp sub-wavelength apertures. If you tried to do this in standard optics, you would get enormous diffraction if you tried to bend light over that short length scale. So this demonstrates the possibility of confining light on these microchips and guiding it in a way that was never possible before. Now, going beyond just passive guiding of light, one wants to consider other types of functionality. Another thing that photonic band gaps do is to control spontaneous emission of light. One of the most common examples of spontaneous emission that we experience is thermal spontaneous emission, or black body radiation. And the question has arisen, can photonic bandgap materials have some influence on the nature of black body radiation? Say, for instance, if one takes a filament that is structured like a photonic crystal and then drives a current through it, heating it up to a certain temperature, effectively, can one come up with a more efficient light-emitting filament or light bulb? Recently, it was shown that in this type of tungsten-based woodpile structure created by a group at Sandia Labs, some very unusual features were actually observed in the blackbody spectrum that comes out of that structure. What they observed is shown in the experimental data down here. In a standard blackbody, you get a peak in the emission corresponding to each particular temperature, and that peak shifts according to the changes in temperature. In this particular tungsten woodpile structure, it was observed that the peak emission by heating could actually be pinned to a particular wavelength over a certain range of temperatures, and some other unusual features appeared which seemed to have something to do with the structure rather than just the thermodynamics of the system. This is the band structure diagram of the tungsten woodpile. Since it's made of metal, what you have is a plasma cutoff frequency which prevents any light propagating through the interior below this cutoff frequency, and you get a large set of bands here. And it's believed that these features are associated with some detailed aspects of the photonic band structure here. So this made us think, can one take this preliminary observation and make it into something more dramatic, that is, have a peak that is placed in the visible spectrum, which is much more robust than the pinning of the peak as you see here. That is, can one come up with an architecture such that the peak would occur in the visible? This would require a material which has a much higher plasma frequency than tungsten. It also requires a material that has a very high melting temperature, say close to 3,000 degrees. So you can't use materials like silver, which have a high plasma frequency but a low melting point. And then to place an isolated passband somewhere below the plasma cutoff frequency. And this particular architecture is one that satisfies those properties. It's called a spiral structure. It can be made by a variety of techniques, which I won't go into. But I'll show you the band structure properties if this architecture were consisting of air inside these cylinders and a particular metal, iridium, outside, which has this very high plasma frequency and a melting point of about 3,000 degrees. So here you see the band structure of that particular architecture. Here, if the lattice constant of the spiral is chosen to be 400 nanometers, one can place an isolated passband which occupies a significant fraction of the visible spectrum, which is well separated and cut off from the rest of the continuum below the plasma cutoff frequency. And this is just a simulation, again, of the electromagnetic field associated with this passband, in which light is actually propagating through the percolating network of interior air holes inside this spiral structure. And this means that if you have thermal light emitters, then light from the interior of the structure coming outwards only has this available electromagnetic density of states to work with, so it places a peak even in thermal emission, which occurs within this isolated passband. In this case, that can be put at about 650 nanometers, and it has a reasonable width associated with it. And one can go into more detail and ask where these modes actually come from. It comes from a sort of a box-like structure inside this spiral arms, where you have intersections between these spiral arms and sort of a grill-like structure where electromagnetic field is concentrated inside these boxes and then propagates from one box to the next and then can pass through the entire structure. So these are sort of grill-like structures where the electromagnetic field is generated by current-driven heat generation. And so this, again, underscores another very interesting possibility of what you can do with photonic bandgap materials, engineering the electromagnetic spectrum. One can look a little bit more detail as to the nature of the change in the electromagnetic spectrum and what it could do to atoms that you might place inside of a photonic bandgap, or in particular, quantum electrodynamics of atom radiation interactions. Suppose that you do place an atom with a transition frequency omega zero, which happens to land inside this photonic bandgap. Well, the light has no modes available to propagate, so it can't go anywhere. But as you know from quantum mechanics, even if there aren't any modes at that frequency, if there are modes at some neighboring frequency, it can still tunnel some distance away from the atom before having to come back. And although spontaneous emission is eliminated, one can have a state which we refer to as a photon-atom bound state, or an eigenstate of the quantum electrodynamic Hamiltonian, which is a linear superposition of the excited atomic state and a photon which occasionally orbits around it. And mathematically, that appears as is shown here. If you consider quantum electrodynamics an ordinary vacuum in which the dispersion relation for light is just featureless, straight line, if you look at the eigen solutions, you get a continuum of solutions for all positive energies corresponding to the scattering states of light from the atom. You get a solution in the complex energy plane, which corresponds to the excited atom, which has a finite lifetime, corresponding to the imaginary part of that solution. If you do that in the photonic bandgap, this solution actually moves to the real energy axis in between the bands above and below, and this describes this photon-atom bound state. And this has actually started a whole area in quantum optics of trying to understand what the consequences of this type of effect are. What I'd like to do is to discuss how that might be used practically for, say, applications in, say, optical switching or even optical transistor type of effects. Now, the idea of optical transistors goes back almost 30 years. One of the earliest ideas was by Hyatt Gibbs and his collaborators. They just considered a very simple but compelling architecture for creating an all-optical transistor. What they said is that let's take a pair of dielectric mirrors, place some nonlinear optical material inside, and then use this as what's called a Fabry-Perot resonator or cavity, so that when you shine light from one side, then if the light is at the right frequency, it will transmit. There's a transmission resonance. And if you now pump this medium with some other laser beam, it can nonlinearly shift the refractive index of what's in here, and that can correspondingly shift the transmission resonance out of resonance with the beam that you wanted to send through. So thereby, by using this secondary laser beam, you can switch the beam that I show in red from being transmitted to being reflected, controlling light with light. Now, one of the problems here is that this has a fundamental limitation. That is, if you want this switching to occur very easily, that is, with very low intensity pumping, you need a very narrow transmission resonance for this probe beam here, which means that the cavity here has to have a very high quality factor, so that you only have to shift it by a little bit to move it out of resonance. Unfortunately, if you have a very narrow frequency resonance, if you think about it from Fourier analysis, time is conjugate to frequency, it means something very narrow in frequency means it takes a very long time for light to get in and out of the cavity, or that the switching time becomes very long, the lower the intensity required for switching. And that can actually be illustrated very graphically in photonic crystals themselves. Here's a Fabry-Perot cavity that is embedded into a waveguide in a photonic crystal. These three rods act as mirrors surrounding this cavity. We consider a pulse that is now going through this structure. Initially, it's reflected, but as the intensity builds up in this cavity, the refractive index of the cavity can be changed. So we start with an initial cavity which has a transmission spectrum that is peaked here, and we send in a light that has its frequency spectrum centered at the green line, and we can nonlinearly shift the transmission spectrum of this, as is shown here, as light intensity builds up. But as you see here, what happens in practice is that the response of the medium, which changes the transmission spectrum, causes it to overshoot the spectrum of the light that's being sent in. And the higher the Q factor of the cavity, the more of these oscillations take place. This leads to slowing down the switching time. It also leads to a distortion of the pulse that comes out of the structure. So here in black is the initial frequency spectrum of the pulse, and what came out here is this blue line. It's being distorted. And so this may not be good if you want to be sending information through this structure and you don't want the data to be destroyed in the process. So what we've been asking is, are there other ways in which one can use the photonic bandgap concept to control light with light, namely by engineering the electromagnetic density of states? And here's an architecture in which we've proposed that might be done. This is a waveguide channel in the three-dimensional photonic bandgap microchip, which actually has two waveguide modes associated with it. And these waveguide modes have the property that one of them exhibits a very sharp cutoff inside the photonic bandgap. The other one has relatively linear dispersion. And what we want to ask is, what if we place quantum dots or other light emitters adjacent to this waveguide, which were those striped rods, in which the transition frequency of those quantum dots corresponds to being very close to this very abrupt cutoff, or effectively this very large jump in the electromagnetic density of states, being relatively small up here and being very large down here, as all of these new modes appear as a function of frequency. Let me just remind you something about what happens if you take two-level systems, a ground and an excited state, say a collection of two-level atoms, and coherently pump them with a laser field. This is something that you learn very early in optics, that if you pump them on steady state, then the response of those atoms can be described very well by the Einstein rate equations, which tell you what is the fraction of atoms that ends up in their excited states relative to the total number of atoms. And provided the density of states is smooth and featureless, you can use Fermi's golden rule to describe absorption and emission of light. And if you solve that problem, what you find is that no matter how high the intensity of the pumping is, the fraction of atoms that ends up in their excited state always remains below a half. In other words, you can't achieve population inversion by coherently pumping on resonance. So anyone who tries to make a laser will tell you that they can put in higher levels into this atom, pump to those higher levels, and then relax down to this level of interest to achieve population inversion and lasing. This, however, is a property of ordinary vacuum, which has this smooth and featureless density of states. And that can be dramatically changed if this density of states has some sharp or abrupt discontinuity corresponding to this transition frequency. And without going into the details of how that is shown, I'll just tell you what the upshot of that investigation was. So consider having a collection of these two-level systems, atoms or quantum dots, which have a resonant transition that occurs very close to this jump discontinuity. Some very interesting effects occur, like what are called vacuum Rabi splitting. The atomic level actually splits into a doublet due to its strong dressing or interaction with this waveguide cutoff mode. But moreover, what we were able to show is that if you take a collection of these atoms and again coherently pump on resonance, it's actually possible to induce collective switching of that atomic system into one in which most of the atoms are in their ground state, which would correspond to an absorbing medium, into one in which they are mostly in their excited state, or to achieve population inversion by coherent pumping on resonance. And we now have some simulations using this concept applied to the type of geometry, switching geometry that I showed before, in which you can have control of one light pulse with another laser beam without the type of distortion that I was talking about earlier. So this is another direction that one might look to in the more distant future for practical applications. Okay, let me just finish then. I hope I've conveyed to you some of the excitement in this field, as well as some of the current work that we're doing, as well as some of the open challenges and issues. I hope I've at least shown you some of the steps that we're taking towards that Edisonian dream of making photonic band gaps very commonplace and very easy to manufacture. Once that is done, one has a number of different possibilities for functional architectures based on this principle of being able to confine or localize light, this property of Maxwell's equations that now allows the existence of localized modes, in particular for the creation of integrated optics, having light process information on a microchip over a large bandwidth, also engineering the electromagnetic density of states for controlling spontaneous emission. One example was just a light emitter, which is thermally heated. Another application is more frequency selective control of spontaneous emission for realizing a number of interesting new quantum electrodynamic effects. Thank you very much. Okay, the question is, if I'm dealing with this iridium-based photonic crystal filament, does the absorption and loss or extinction of light in the iridium play a role? Yes, when we do the finite difference time domain simulation, we put an imaginary part of the dielectric constant in there. So there is some absorption, but there's a sufficient heating taking place that there can be more emission than absorption. In the case of the pass bands that I showed, the electromagnetic energy was largely concentrated in the air fraction without being focused back into the iridium itself, so thereby it can avoid a lot of that absorption effect. But you're right, as you heat up the material more and more, you induce more and more absorption, higher resistance is generated in the metal, and that will indeed affect the properties of the light-emitting filament. But in spite of that absorption effect, we would still see this peak in the emission spectrum that is placed at about 650 nanometers, which is separated from any other feature.
Okay, I can give you an example. In the old days, when you produced gratings for spectrographs in a mechanical fashion, then you had a certain repetition frequency in the production process, 857. So every 857 lines, you started a new cycle, and that produced ghost lines in the spectrum, which were not real, but they were there. So I can imagine that when you do laser lighting, there have to be some kind of periodicities in it, either mechanical or electrical or whatever. Have they been observed? Would they matter?
I take it that your question deals with some structures that are manufactured that were not intended that would create unusual features. That's an issue. I mean, one of the most apparent issues is, nothing can be made to perfection. There's going to be some random disorder in the structure. So there are some unwanted modes that will appear now and then. And sometimes those are...
This would be not random.
Okay.
Because they have to be
okay.
Based on the production process.
At this point, I'm not aware of anything that's periodic like that, but there may be some manufacturing processes that lead to that. I'm not sure. There are ways and people who are planning to do that. I think the biggest lateral dimension of photonic bandgap that has been made so far is basically on an 8-inch wafer, which was done by Sean Lin at Sandia Laboratories, but he only grew that to about 2 or 3 lattice constants in height. This was done by standard semiconductor microlithography, so it's a laborious layer-by-layer process. In these sorts of approaches, say by optical phase mass lithography, presumably you could still reach the centimeter scale. It depends on how well you can illuminate uniformly over such a large scale and how well that laser interference diffraction pattern goes into the depth of the structure, but I imagine it could go 30, 40 lattice constants easily. For a lot of the applications, you don't have to make it that deep. Once you have even, 3 lattice constants of depth, you have a very well-defined photonic band gap inside. So if you put a light emitter there, it'll act as if, it's almost in an infinite system. But the direct laser writing is somewhat more limited. About 100 by 100 micron structures are possible. But we're working on trying to improve the manufacturing processes.
You may have mentioned this and I missed it, but is the speed of light in a structure like the one at the top there, is it still the same as the speed of light in vacuum?
I didn't get a chance to say that. No, actually, in the structure that you see at the top, along that air waveguide channel in the plane, the speed of light, I think, is somewhere between a third and a quarter of the speed of light in vacuum. I mean, it is interacting with the dielectric around it, so something has to happen. And in the vertical link, it's somewhere between 1/8 and 1/10 of the speed of light in vacuum. But in those regions, it still has fairly linear dispersion.
These 3 plus 1 dimensional materials, the size
Well, if you're just talking about a dielectric stack, you can have a photonic band gap or stop gap in that one direction. But in terms of guiding light, there's nothing to prevent it from disappearing in all those other directions. So this is really aimed at having complete confinement of light preventing any sort of diffractive losses. Now, there are definitely applications for lower dimensional periodic structures, such as your dielectric stack. Even in the fibers, you can take a dielectric stack and bend it around into a fiber and have a hollow core, and that's what a company called OmniGuide does. You can guide CO2 laser light, which has the 10 micron wavelength through that, but it's very hard to bring that down to shorter wavelengths with those one-dimensional structures. So this is to realize complete confinement, essentially, and control spontaneous emission.
Are there any more questions? No, let's thank the speaker again.